The following is an encore episode of Hour 1 of the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. We hope you enjoy.
You've tuned to the Turley Frequency, starring your host, Kevin Turley, with guest stars Mike Romano and Reed Hodges, and special guest stars, the members of the FCC, whom we respect respectfully. Now, time to get tuned into The Frequency. Call the show at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. Or text us at 251-928-2111. And now we cross live to the Archangel Radio Studios in downtown Fairhope to at last feel the Turley Frequency.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to the Turley Frequency on this Friday, the last Friday in July. Today on the show, we meet futurist, author, neuroscientist, and intelligent officer, Dr. Eric Heseltine, when, among other things, he will be discussing how our brains work. Yes, that's right. We get all brainy in the next segment. Top of the hour, we pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and guess what? You're invited to join us. That's right. Feel free to text me your prayer requests on 251-928-2111. World Youth Day fast approaches, and we explore the links between that forthcoming event and the U.S. National Eucharistic Congress. When in the final segment, we meet the Chief Mission Officer for the forthcoming National Eucharistic Congress here in the States, Mr. Joel Stepanek. Okay, with all that good stuff, I guess we'd better get this show on the road. Hello and welcome back to the final edition of the Turley Frequency this week. It's been a wonderful week. It's been such a journey through it with you. I've enjoyed every single moment of it. I hope you have enjoyed some of it too. This is a Friday in July. It's the last Friday in July. I know we celebrate the first Friday in the Catholic Church. I'm not sure we celebrate the last Friday. But anyway, it's Friday, which is enough to be celebrated, right? Especially in this month dedicated to the precious blood. Now, on Fridays, those of us who are working through the week, Friday is a day when our brains start to hurt a bit, right? Do you know what I mean? Friday's the day when you start to feel your age. You start to slow down, right? You start to think, oh, I can't wait for the weekend. I can't wait not to have to work on Saturday and Sunday. That's what most people think. I don't think it, of course. I could do this job 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. But most people by Friday have had enough and their brains are hurting. But fear not, we will be frying our brains in the best possible way with our guest, Dr. Eric Heseltine, this morning and finding out how to get more out of our brains, even on a Friday. Now, by the way, I took a look this morning, just for your benefit, at the Sound of Freedom box office receipts. Guess what? $133 million this morning. It shot up $3 million in the last 24 hours or so. Isn't that amazing? If last weekend is anything to go by, the Sound of Freedom will hit around about $150 million this weekend, or certainly in the coming weeks. Certainly by early August, it will be $150 million. There must be a number of very nervous people around Walt Disney. The company that turned it down, that cold storaged the movie. There must be some executive who made that final decision sitting there squirming every time he looks at the box office receipts for Sound of Music. Sound of Freedom, the music of the box office tills for Sound of Freedom. Now listen, Hollywood itself, as you know, keeps making the news. Every time I go to a website, a news feed, there's something about Hollywood because the strike is on, right? Hollywood is in turmoil. Well, that's the headline. It just means they're not making any movies. They're not making any TV shows at the moment until the dispute is sorted out. And it will get sorted out, I'm absolutely certain. Because the producers and the TV execs and film producers, they want to make movies, they want to make money. And guess what? The people who act in them, star in them, write them, and all the rest of it, they need to make money too. So sooner or later, common sense will prevail. But a new angle came today on the New York Times. I couldn't believe it. I never thought of this, partly because I'm a little bit behind the times. I'm not as young as I should be when it comes to this matter, because in this Hollywood strike, there has been some surprising collateral damage. You heard that right, collateral damage. Guess what? Influencers are suffering. Remember them? No, I know. Listen, I don't quite get it myself. I never heard of these people until I was reading this article. I mean, I'm not even quite sure what is an influencer. I know what influenza is, and you don't want to get that. But I wonder what an influencer is. Let's maybe ask somebody. Reed, you're a sort of young, hip individual. What is an influencer?
An influencer is really just somebody who they can be paid, or sometimes they're not paid. I would imagine, actually, the majority of people who think they're influencers are not paid. And they think that they have influence with their social media posts. So really, you know, if they're a popular person, then that can have an effect on the amount of people they're able to reach. But there's a lot of people who call themselves influencers, and they really have no influence at all.
There's no need to bring me into this conversation.
you're a host, Kevin. That's an official thing. An influencer is an Instagram title.
Right. So, well, look, I mean, some of them, you're right, are influencers only in their front room. But others have TikTok and YouTube channels and so forth, Twitter accounts, which have many, many millions of followers. So these people, that's who they're influencing, right? All these followers, these disciples that they have picked up along the way, right?
Certainly.
Okay. Well, let me tell you, the headline this morning in the New York Times says Hollywood strike leaves influencers sidelined and confused. Despite not being in the actors union, many content creators, it seems, are having to pass up very lucrative deals to promote movies, TV shows and the like, because they don't want to be barred from the guild or, and this is very important for influencers, to face online vitriol. Now, the article has some of these influencers who I've never heard of, but they are people with millions of followers, and they seem to earn quite a lot of money. There was one young woman called Dina, who's not in the Actors Union, but she turned down, just last week, a $28,000 deal because of the strike. And what was the deal? It was one offer to promote a new television series called Only Murders in the Building. Now, I've never heard of the TV series Only Murders in the Building. I've never heard of her. But $28,000 to promote it? Listen, if there's anybody out there, I mean, I don't think the radio is included in this strike. If anybody wants to pay this show $28, we would probably give it a mention.
Without all the zeros, Kevin? You don't even need all the zeros?
Listen, you know, the way we are, $28 and a few, whatever. We'd have to run it past our good friend Michelle and Ellen, but that's how cheap we are. Radio is a cheap medium, and if there's anybody out there who wants to advertise on this station, you just need to call our good friend Shannon here at the station, and we'll sort it out for you.
We'll be happy to influence our audience for you.
We can do that for you, but I can't get my head around it. $28,000 to talk about a TV show. It's a lot of dollars to talk about something. She must be very good, this woman. She must be very, very fluid. But you see, this is the problem that these influencers are coming a lot. There's a lot of these Dinas out there, and they were never members of the union. This is the thing. They're not members of the SAG-AFTRA, which used to be the Screen Actors Guild. They're not part of that. So they're not bound by the legitimate rules of a strike engagement. If you're a member of a union and it goes on strike, you're morally obliged, I guess, not to work. You're breaking the strike, right? But if you're not a member of that union, if you've got no ties to it, yes, you're working in the industry indirectly. I mean, that woman is, she's not an actress. She's not a screenwriter. All she does is talk about the show on her YouTube or TikTok or whatever it is. But the moral force of the argument from the strikers is beginning to hit this group of influencers. And they all tend to be very, very young. And they're certainly all in their 20s. And they just don't want to feel that they are somehow compromised by promoting something in the middle of the strike, something that emanates from Hollywood. I think one or two of them did try to do that, and they got so much abuse and so much bad publicity that it wasn't worth the check. It wasn't worth the money that they were being paid. Now, the union is playing real hardball with these influencers, and it's saying that anybody who sort of starts to involve themselves as influencers, content creation, to promote a product from Hollywood, they will be blocked from membership of the union, which is a code word of saying that they will be somehow given a certain reputation within the industry, a reputation that they wouldn't want to have. So there's a little bit of influence going towards the influencers, and it's not a nice sort. It's the kind of influence that the mafia has when they're going around demanding protection money. There's an element of threat here, and the influencers are buckling. They are buckling. They've got no choice, really. They're in a no-win situation, right? They totally are. If they turn up even at a red carpet event, you know, some sort of premiere of a movie, that will be enough to put them onto this list. Okay. Now, a lot of these people, they spend their lives, their YouTube channels are sort of the glamour and the glitz around the movie industry. They talk about the films, they maybe interview the stars, they maybe go to the premieres, the parties and all the rest of it. You know, that's the world that they kind of focus on. So if that world doesn't exist, they don't have a job either. Now, I know most people in the real world would say, well, they're a sort of parasitic element. You know, they live off another organism, which is the movie industry, which is a creative industry. But even so, they are doing it very well. And the industry likes them, or has liked them up till now, because it does a lot of free promotion, a lot of marketing to that elusive segment in the marketing world, which is, of course, people in their 20s. Marketeers are always scratching their head. How can we reach these young people? Well, these influencers are the way that they have been going about it. I felt sorry for another young woman who has 1.2 million TikTok followers. And she was very happy promoting X, Y, and Z. And then suddenly she got a message from the union saying, you know, or it was made clear to her on her TikTok that what she was doing wasn't such a good thing. And she was really confused because she'd never even heard of this union. I don't even think she was aware there was a strike on. But there she was. Suddenly. She said, I really do value creators and I want them to get what they deserve, but it's really hard for me to just be finding out about an organization and to be expected to fall into line with their initiative when I feel like it's new to me and the influencer space. Sounds a little bit like that joke video we played the other day. Do you remember the woman who went for the job interview and then said at the end, are you firing me? It's a bit like that. It sounds a little bit like that. Now, this young woman didn't get a lot of sympathy for me because the amount of bad publicity she got was because she turned up at Barbie, at a Barbie premiere somewhere, and started to talk about it. And she got a lot of negative feedback, she said, and she was finding it a little bit, quotes, scary. So she's learning about the real world, I'm afraid. She's learning that things are not as they seem sometimes in the shiny world of influencers. And so it goes on. There's a whole list of them here. I could take you through them all. They've all got millions of followers. I don't know how they do it. That's what I was wondering. They're all just quietly hoping that the strike will end and soon. Now, one other casualty of this strike is something which I'm sure we're all going to be brokenhearted about, and that is the bad news which just came through this morning that the Emmy Awards have been postponed. I know, it's tragic. Reed, I think that's really insensitive. It really is a tragedy. Okay. Very funny. Very funny, Reed. Well, I mean, what are we going to do if the Emmys are postponed and indefinitely as well? What are we going to do about all those speeches that those award-winning actors make, you know? The actors that tell us and the actresses that tell us how they are overwhelmed by this award and what it means to them and all the rest.
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
No, thank you. Thank you. That was a wonderful piece of acting. I think that was Sally Field from many years ago. And she was obviously, they liked her. They liked her a lot. They gave her an award. And she was obviously chuffed, as we say, this side of the Atlantic. She was very pleased with it. But what are we going to do without those sorts of speeches? You know, what are we going to do? How are we going to cope? How are we going to cope? How are we going to cope if there's not a Barbie 2 movie on in the near future or an Oppenheimer, the sequel? Can't think how you're going to do a sequel for Oppenheimer. I mean, once the bomb goes off, I mean, what happens next? You know, the debris? Oppenheimer, the debris? Anyway, now there is an actor. We're going back to the Sound of Freedom, and Sound of Freedom has been with us all week. So let's finish off this week with it. Now there is an actor who has a different take on all of this, and as comes as no surprise, it's Mr. Jim Caviezel, the star of Sound of Freedom, and the star of the current box office hit out there. Now what he has to say about acting and the whole experience of making a piece of art, such as a film, is a little bit different from what we're hearing from the influencers and the unions and even Sally Field. Let's have a little listen to what he said recently in an interview.
There were great martyrs, and we had to go through a martyrdom with our faith, with our reputations on the line. St. Faustina. And out of that, you have other great martyrs that were willing to give their... Some of it's white martyrdom, and sometimes it's red martyrdom. But the point being is that we all end up dying someday. We're all going to die. We're all going to be on our cross. And Jesus will be there. And your family might not be there, but he will be there with you. And there's nothing more beautiful to look at when you're going through that kind of suffering.
So there you have it. There you have it. That's the voice of an actor. An actor whose vocation is acting. He's not in it for the awards, not in it for the money, and certainly not in it for the TikTok influencer approval, because Jim Caviezel has had his fair share of abuse in the last few days in the mainstream media and elsewhere, all sorts of accusations about him being into conspiracies and all sorts of weird stuff. But there it is. That's what truly being following your vocation is all about. It's a martyrdom. Why? What's martyrdom? It's not that Jim Caviezel and the cast and crew of Sound and Freedom have been put up against a wall and machine gun. That's not what he's talking about. Because the word martyr is not about simply dying to the faith. The word martyr is actually about witnessing to the faith. And as Jim Caviezel has just shown us, anybody following their vocation properly, there will be moments when it will suffer. You will suffer as a result of following that vocation. So it's not about awards. It's not about money. It's about something else. And the applause comes later, and it comes from on high. Okay, listen, when we come back, we're changing the tune. We're going to be looking into our brains and finding out what's left on this Friday when we meet a neuroscientist who has a very interesting take on what they are capable of. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Welcome back to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. It's great to have your company this Friday morning. Now, it is something we use every day, from the opening of our eyes in the morning to their shutting last thing at night. And even during the wee small hours of the night, we are still using it. Of what do I speak? Well, the brain, of course. But I would wager that most of us have no idea how our brains work. Or indeed, what they are potentially capable of. Well, my next guest can help us with this. Dr. Eric Heseltine is a neuroscientist who has written extensively on the subject of the brain. His critically acclaimed book, Long Fuse, Big Bang, explores the neuroscience of innovation. With his wife, Dr. Chris Gilbert, he has co-authored the book, The Listening Cure, which reveals the critical role the brain plays in our health. He appears regularly in the media in such places as Fox News, Bloomberg News, ABC Television, NBC Television, and so on. His popular blog at psychologytoday.com translates cutting-edge neuroscience into easy-to-understand, compelling stories that help people better understand their brains. Now, if that was not enough, he is also a futurist. And he also has another role that is equally thought-provoking. Get this. He serves as the executive vice president in charge of research and development for the Walt Disney Company. That's right. Dr. Eric Heseltine, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Eric, there is so much in your CV, in your resume. I'm really not sure where to start, but maybe we could just start with a neuroscience to begin with, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
well,
most people listen.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, sorry, please.
No, I was going to say I got to start in an interesting area. I did my PhD on pythons, boas, and rattlesnakes and understanding how their brains see in the dark.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, being a radio talk show host, I'm not often stumped for words, but I am this morning. I don't really know, Dr. Eric, how to come back on that one. But let's begin at the beginning, okay? And let's assume there's somebody listening who knows nothing about neuroscience. You're sitting on a plane, you meet me, and I say, "Hey, doctor, what do you do?" And you tell me, and I say, "Hey, what's a neuroscientist?" What would you say?
We try to figure out how the brain works.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically it. It covers all aspects of the nervous system, the brain, the spinal cord, peripheral nerves. And it's probably one of the hottest areas in science right now.
Yes, I can imagine.
Because brain imaging and brain implants and AI has made a big impact on neuroscience too, because with AI we can interpret brain signals and, for example, control robots so that people who are paralyzed, for example, some cases using external robots can walk.
That's right. Now, all joking aside, I mean, the whole area of neuroscience touches on the whole expanding area of AI at the moment, which is always in the news and always negatively in the news, or certainly a lot of it's negatively. But it is about, I mean, we often forget what AI stands for. It's artificial intelligence. And what the brain is ultimately about, I guess, is a form of intelligence, human intelligence. Is there a correlation between how AI works and how the human brain works?
There's a weak correlation. Right now, many of the AI algorithms use what's called neural nets, which are a crude approximation of how learning happens in the brain. But it's very crude. The way computers work and the way the brain works are actually very, very different. We shouldn't forget that the brain is biological wet tissue. And the startling fact is that in some ways, we don't even know the most rudimentary things about how the brain communicates with itself. You know, if you go to the textbooks, there's an answer. But those of us who actually study the brain will tell you that what we don't know about the brain is infinitely more than what we do know.
Yes, and I can imagine that that is the case. Is there also a differentiation that needs to be made between the study of the brain per se as an organism and consciousness, which is something which, you know, most of us don't think about the brains, but we're aware of consciousness. Is there a divide in that, or are they interrelated in your studies? Have you discovered that there's a direct relationship between the two?
Well, the study of consciousness is normally done by psychologists who study perception, memory, cognition, and so forth, who aren't, strictly speaking, neuroscientists. They deal with brain function at a much higher level. However, there is a branch of neuroscience that studies consciousness, and there's a really heated debate over what is the purpose of consciousness. You know, for example, there's a lot of research that suggests that most behavior is driven unconscious.
Yes.
There's some fascinating studies that show that, I won't go into the details, but that when we decide to act, we do it before our consciousness is aware of it. And our consciousness is more of an observer of what we do than a cause of what we do.
That's really interesting.
So that raises,
I mean, is this
the question? Yeah.
Sorry, forgive me.
Well, that raises the question of what is the function of consciousness? There are some neuroscientists who believe it's what we call an epiphenomena. It's just there as a side effect of what else goes on in the brain. And there are others who say, no, consciousness is what we use to monitor things, and when there are errors, to correct errors. So there really isn't any unanimity over what consciousness is and why it's there.
No, and certainly in the world of psychology as well, I know there's been a lot of heated debate about the whole business of the subconscious, kicked off by a certain Dr. Freud, about what that means for us as well. So consciousness, subconscious, that's not your area of expertise. Your expertise is around just how the brain functions, I guess.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I've done a lot of work, and most of my publications actually are around those hidden functions in your brain that would surprise you. I wrote this book called Brain Safari that's all about diving deep into those parts of your behavior and perception that are there that you're not aware of. And really, it was more fun. The book was more entertainment for families and kids to do together to discover things that their brain keeps hidden from them.
Well, that's one of the things when I was looking you up today and reading about you, I was very interested in that whole idea that somehow we're using our brains. So most of us are not using our brains as much as they could be used, in a sense, you know, that we're running on a very low capacity. Would that be a fair, that was my extrapolation from what I was reading this morning. Is that a fair suggestion that most of us aren't aware of the capacity and the capability of our own brains?
Well, that's true. Most of what goes on is far below the conscious level, because it has to be. When you're walking or driving, you don't mentally control each and every muscle that's doing things. When you're talking, you actually, most people don't know what they're going to say before they say it, because it's far too complex. So our brain hides all that detail from us. So I would say, though, that you're right in the sense that most people can achieve far more than what they think they can. there is a paradigm we call learned helplessness. And the example is the baby elephant who, as an infant, is staked to a pole, like at a circus, and it can't get away. But when it becomes an adult, it could pull the stake up like a twig, but it never does. They keep the adult elephant captive that way. And because what the elephant learned as a baby is what it couldn't do. And so we call that learned helplessness. And most of us have that. Most of us, because of society or because of whatever, think that there's a lot that we can't do. And in fact, the human brain is capable of marvelous things. And as a more old American, I'm now 71, I'm really struck by how people expect older people to diminish in intellectual capacity and achievement. And that doesn't have to be true at all. But it becomes true if people believe it's true. So I like to say, as we believe, so we achieve.
No, I mean, I'm totally with you on that. I've often thought that, that because I've seen it in people's lives, and you must have seen this as well, Dr. Eric, where people from a very early age are conditioned to believe this is what you will achieve, this is what you will become, and they do. That's what they achieve. And it's a kind of societal conditioning, but it's something which somehow becomes part of who they are. And but there is a whole sort of industry out there at the moment, and I don't know what your take is on it, which is actually quite helpful, I think, for people, because it's actually dismantling a lot of that and saying that, you know, it's a little bit glib at times saying you can be whatever you want and all that sort of thing. But there's an element of truth in it, which is that people do not realize their own potential most of the time. Is that something to do with your researches in terms of neuroscience?
Yes.
Or is that, again, something to do with the psychological side of things?
Well, I would say it's a very big part of my writing. Like I say, in my book, Brain Safari, almost all of the chapters in there are about taking a safari deep into the unexplored reaches of your own brain and discovering what's there so that you can live a better life. You know, for example, if you have bad habits, way back in the day, I was a psychotherapist, and my clinical supervisor said, you can't let go of something you don't know that you have. And so a lot of people aren't aware of what's going on inside of them. My focus in psychotherapy was as a domestic violence counselor for men and women.
Right.
And what I found with violent men was that they weren't aware of the feelings that were going on inside of them. And most of them had the experience of literally watching themselves hit their wife, because they had pushed down their anger and their rage, and it just all exploded. And so that's a really good example of how to improve people's lives by getting them in touch with what's actually going on down inside. And to me, what's fascinating is how our brains have come to the point where they do all of this stuff automatically without your permission. And they may be doing it for good reasons, or they may not. And so diving in and understanding what's actually going on gives you some agency and some choice, and you're not just kind of following into habits.
Absolutely, and that's what makes it so exciting and so interesting. But it also probably makes it quite frightening for people, because you talked about learned helplessness and certain learned ways of behaving or reacting to situations. What you're suggesting to people is ultimately that they have to start again. They have to examine why they do what they do. And for some people, that can be pretty frightening, right?
For most people. I mean, as they say, you know, we are creatures of habit. We follow the path of least resistance. And that's because our brains consume 20 to 25% of our calories. If we use our brain too much, we might starve to death. The brain has hardwired algorithms in it. Like, for example, some evolutionary biologists at UC San Diego observed that I'm a professor. I'm going to a workout in a gym, and yet I want to park as close to the entrance as I can. And those things are unconscious. Your brain wants you to conserve energy because it doesn't want you to starve to death. It's also why we have an obesity epidemic, because your brain really doesn't want you to starve to death, and it says eat what you can when you can. So there are all of these scripts that are deeply embedded in your brain, most of which are there for a good reason, but we need to understand them and question them because they're not always in our interest.
This is fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Listen, if you have any questions for Dr. Eric Heseltine, I'm happy to pose them. Or text me, 251-928-2111, or telephone the show on 888-928-0881. We're exploring the brains, and it's getting more mysterious by the minute. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Video. Back to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I'm in conversation this morning with Dr. Eric Heseltine, who is a futurist, an author, a neuroscientist, and intelligence officer. But he's also a very, very interesting man. Dr. Eric, I have a question for you from our audience. It says here, why does there seem to be more disorders like autism about these days? Is it better diagnosis or is it just more prevalent?
We don't know. That is an area of hot debate. One thing we do know is that older parents, particularly the older father, are more likely to produce an autistic offspring. And as we have the aging of the population and people are waiting to have families and second marriages and so forth, that's probably one of the reasons. There could be environmental reasons, toxins, things of that nature. But the fact is we just don't know. It's probably not something that happens after birth. Is probably something that happens in the womb during embryogenesis, where circuits that normally form in the cerebral cortex, which is the kind of more the largest part when you look at the brain, you think of that as the brain, those circuits don't develop properly. And so that's something that happens in embryogenesis. And what triggers that, whether it's genetic, whether it's environmental, whether it's a combination, it's one of the big mysteries. We just don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you are a self-described futurist. Mm-hmm. And a few years ago, I had the great pleasure of, for a newspaper article, going to a futurist convention here in London. And I met a lot of futurists and had a fascinating day with them talking about some of their ideas. They were really into this idea of a kind of merging of the human consciousness with artificial intelligence. That's how they saw the future eventually going. Would you share that opinion?
I don't know about the merging. It depends on how you define it. I will say that brain-computer interfaces, where we interface with our thought and our feelings with technology, are definitely going to happen, and they're already happening. And you're seeing it first in neurology and neurosurgery. I have a friend at the Mayo Clinic who implants devices in people who have Parkinson's and other motor diseases, and they have Wi-Fi attached to them, and he can see on his iPhone how they're doing. So he's communicating directly with their brains. I think I mentioned neuroprosthetics for people who were paralyzed, are starting to come along. And so I think what you're going to see as a first step is brain-computer interfaces for therapeutic reasons. But then you're going to start to see them for other reasons. And strangely, a potential big breakthrough that's just been made, not in neuroscience, but in physics, is in high-temperature superconductors. And I won't go into what that means, but what it means from the brain's point of view is people could wear sensors and stimulators outside the skull so they don't have to go through and implant something in the brain that can sense and stimulate. And in fact, there were research done between India and London and Harvard where they actually hooked up some superconducting sensors and stimulators and had thoughts transmitted across the planet over email. So someone said, think thumbs up or thumbs down. And that thought was transmitted from one brain to another over the internet. And this has been successfully shown. Very crude, but I think it does talk about what's going on in the future, because when you think about a telephone, for example, it started off way back 150 years ago as being something that was, you know, in another town. Then it was in a telegraph office. Then it was in your home downstairs. And now it was in every room. And now you're carrying it on your person. And now it's in your ear. That trend is going to continue, and it's going to pierce the veil, as it were. And I do believe sometime down the road, we're going to communicate with our technology and with each other through direct mental activity.
Fascinating prospect. Now, just this month, you're probably aware, the UN Security Council held its first ever meeting about the potential threat of AI to our civilization. Do you share the gloomy prognosis that's out there about AI in general?
I think it's something we have to take seriously. You know, there's never been a technology invented that didn't have potential for good or for evil. That humans have both, and therefore their technology, which they invent, have both. And so already you see AI being used by hackers to do a more effective job of breaking into networks, but you also seeing it being used to defend. But I'll tell you what I think. The concerns about AI that you hear, kind of like the Terminator, Skynet, and so forth.
That's right.
The things that we imagine are probably not the things that are going to cause us trouble. It's the things we can't imagine. And the reason those things are going to be a problem is specifically because we're not prepared for them. They're the black swans, the 9/11s or whatever. So I think there could be some very big problems with AI, but not in areas that we're now thinking about. The things that hit us the most are the things we're not thinking about. And so how do we approach this? How do we harvest the benefits of AI without suffering the downside? And the short answer is, I don't think we do. I think we're going to have to handle it the way we handle other powerful technologies, such as nuclear weapons and biological technologies. We're just going to have to be informed. You know, your average person out there listening to this show, I think the only thing they can do is just stay informed so that decisions don't get made without your input.
Absolutely. I mean, you're absolutely right, because, I mean, who would have thought that we would be sitting here in July 23 when there's a Hollywood strike related to Hollywood, and one of the key components of the dispute, the industrial dispute, is around AI. Who would have thought that?
Yeah. Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because I have a friend who's using AI, Midjourney and ChatGPT, to help people develop their own graphic novels. And some of those can be animated with AI characters. So I think we are fast approaching the point in time where you could replace writers, directors, actors, could all be done with AI. And so automation, which has traditionally replaced blue-collar jobs, is already threatening to replace white-collar, skillful jobs.
Absolutely.
My wife is a physician, and she uses AI all the time in order to kind of learn more and reinforce her knowledge. And my guess is that a ton of physicians use AI a lot more than they maybe would want to tell their patients. Not that my wife does, but because it's really good. I mean, I use it in my work. I have a laboratory where I'm doing a lot of work with magnetic phenomena. And I use it to understand things that I would normally have trouble understanding. It's like having a world-class expert right at your elbow. So it is a tremendous boon. But like I said, we need to take it very seriously, and we need to not let things unfold all on their own. We need to try to stay on top of it, because it could spin out of control.
Well, it's just, I mean, just as you're speaking there, Dr. Eric, I'm thinking you're absolutely right. It is like having a world-class expert at your fingertips. But we go back to where we started, which is about learned helplessness. And I'm afraid there's something in human nature, which if somebody else can do it quicker, and they're at a fingertip away, literally pressing a button, is it going to – I'm wondering, is this encounter with AI the real danger in that we are going to be using our brains less?
That's very perceptive. And I think that is a huge danger because the brain is like a muscle. The more you use it, the stronger it gets. And that's why learned helplessness comes in. If you don't think you can, you're not going to use it, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because it very much is if your brain gets out of shape. And the way to keep your brain in shape is to do things just like lifting weights that are hard for your brain and novel for your brain and challenging for your brain. That's how to keep your brain young and fit and, you know, not subject to the vagaries of old age. I think that is one of the unexpected. Like, how many kids know how to do long division now? They just use a calculator. On the other hand, just looking at my own life, I could spend a lot of time going back into the physics textbooks to understand Maxwell's equations and so forth. Or I could just ask the AI. And once I ask the AI, I'm there and I can move on to the next stage. And so the products that I'm developing are developing much faster, cheaper, and quicker. So I don't know. It's a mixed bag. And I think that it's unique in a sense in that we're creating a technology which could rival us. And that's never happened before. But on the other hand, I think that the potential for good is there. And so, like I said, I don't think it's different in that it has bipotentiality. But this one, we do have to stay on top of it.
Now, you made a very interesting point there, which I totally agree with, which is that all technological advances ultimately have potential for good or evil. And ultimately, it comes back to us human beings, how we determine their use. Which makes me wonder, in all your years of studying the brain and the humanity that is operated by it, what conclusions have you come to about that kind of human interface, that potentiality within us for good or for evil?
Wow. Well, I think of technology as an amplifier of what's already there, not a creator of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you think about evil and conquerors throughout history, they can only do so much because of the technology. But today, a conqueror could destroy the whole human race with nuclear weapons. And so the technology is just an amplifier of what's already there. And, you know, so this is an interesting thing. When I was in the intelligence world, my focus was on roadside bombs in Iraq and Afghanistan. And after 2 years working that problem in Iraq and Afghanistan, I realized that it wasn't the technology problem. I mean, that was my job to counter the technology. It was a human problem. Why are these people trying to kill us? What is their motivation? And what can we do about the motivation, not the technology? And so we started making some progress when we looked at the tribal structure and what was going on with that and kind of the anthropology of the region. And so really, it's a fascinating point, but the answer to the challenges posed by technology are not technology. They're in our hearts and in our souls.
I think that's an absolutely fascinating observation from somebody who is as well studied in these matters as you are, that it's ultimately coming back to what it is to be human, never mind AI advances right, left and center. Now, this is a Catholic radio station, Dr. Eric. Any observations that you've seen in these years about the relationship between belief, religious belief and action and its use in the brain, positive or negative?
Well, again, I think that there's a lot we don't understand. There are some neuroscientists who study faith and what's going on in the brain with it. I'll tell you my own experiences of having worked in disadvantaged communities as part of being a therapist is that I have seen faith have a tremendous positive effect on health and on behavior because it there's an element of it, obviously, with tremendous optimism and belief that things are possible.
True.
And I think that I would never want to take that away from anyone. I think that the feelings that come with faith, and there's a lot of research on health. This is something my wife can speak a lot more about because she's a physician. She's a real doctor. I'm just a brain doctor. But people who have strong faith and, more importantly, strong connections to faith community, regular church going and so forth, that tends to be really good for your health. I mean, because in a way, we all need to feel we belong. We're a social species. We depend upon each other. And in some ways, it's a fiction that we're individuals. We really are a collective, a group in some ways. And so one of the tremendous benefits of faith for health is that it makes us feel belong, and it eases our anxiety. And stress and anxiety are a huge problem for our health. This is what our book, The Listening Cure, is all about, mind-body medicine, how our brains has an unbelievable effect upon our health. And mainly it has to do with stress and stress hormones.
Oh, absolutely. Dr. Haseltine, it's been an absolute pleasure and a fascinating opportunity to talk to you about all these things. And we never even got near your work in the intelligence world or even your work with Walt Disney, a mouse divided at the moment. Listen, could you tell people where they can find out more about your work and also where they can find out about your books?
Yes, I have a website, www.drhaseltine.com. And you can catch me on Psychology Today. I have a blog called Long Fuse Big Bang, in which I write about many of these topics. You can go to Amazon for our books. Our latest one is Writing the Monsters, with my wife, 5 Ways to Innovate Inside Bureaucracies. And I wrote a spy thriller that's true. It's based on a true story called The Spy in Moscow Station. And you can get that on Amazon, too, along with Brain Safari, Long Fuse Big Bang, and The Listening Cure.
Dr. Eric, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the show this morning.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Okay, when we come back, we're not going to be talking about the brain so much as we're going to be praying. We're going to be praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio.